Outside the wall stretches a great moat, across which access to the city is given by massive causeways. Flanking the causeways on each side are 54 divinities, resembling warlords in stone, huge and terrifying. All five gates are the same. The parapets of the causeways are of solid stone, carved to represent nine-headed serpents. The 54 divinities grasp the serpents with their hands, seemingly to prevent their escape. Above each gate are grouped five gigantic heads of Buddha, four of them facing the four cardinal points of the compass. The fifth head, brilliant with gold, holds a central position. On each side of the gates are elephants, carved in stone. About 200 yards beyond the south gate rises a mighty stone tower, which, it is said, was built in a single night. The tomb, Angkor Wat, is 400 yards distant from the south gate. It is 2.5 miles in circumference and contains several hundred stone rooms. Hello there, and welcome back to In the Shadows of Utopia. This is Lachlan Peters. Alright, so this is part two of the rise and fall of the Khmer Empire. And I've started us off here with a section of Chota Khan's 13th century recount of his 1 year stay in Angkor. The chapter was called The Walled City, which sort of describes the layout of the Khmer capital city, the grandiose monuments and structures, which made a big impression on him and other visitors to what was the biggest city in the world at that point in time. We will revisit Zhou's account toward the end of the episode, because it's actually hugely important for historians studying the period, and also because it's just a fascinating little book. But before that, let's just briefly catch up on where we are at after the last episode, part one. Last time out, we left the discussion dangling on the edge of the Khmer Empire's rise to dominance of mainland Southeast Asia. We talked about the ancient kingdoms that gave rise to Angkor, Funan, and then Chenla. We talked about how Jayavarman II started the royal cult of the Devaraja, where kings were seen as manifestations of Hindu gods like Vishnu or Shiva. I explained the significance of this royal cult and their fondness for building these temple mountains, which are kind of like these brilliant stone pyramids which symbolize the home of the gods in Hindu mythology. I also explained to you the relationship between the rain, the land, and the people in ancient Cambodia, how the Khmer Empire was based on this mastery of the elements, how they built a kind of aquatic city, utilizing a complex system of canals and these vast artificial lakes that supported an advanced kind of agriculture, which became the foundation for an empire. We left the story at the end of Yasovarman's reign, in around 900 AD. He's remembered as a great king who moved the capital of the Khmer Empire to the site referred to today as Angkor, the city that would be the capital of the empire for more than 500 years, and the home of the most impressive examples of design and architecture in the region. So that's where we're at. The end of the reign of Yasovarman and just about the beginning of the real so-called golden era of Cambodian history. And that's what we're going to talk about in the episode today. The real heights of this period, but also how it came to an end, and how the Khmer Empire would start to begin looking more like, well, Cambodia. Do you remember Age of Empires? These video games were kind of a big deal around the super late 90s, early 2000s. If you played them, or maybe you still play them now, like I do sometimes, specifically Age of Empires 2, which is probably the best, and funnily enough got an expansion pack only like a couple of years ago that added the Khmer Empire as a playable civilization. Anyway, like I said, if you played these games, you'll no doubt remember them fondly, and if you haven't, basically the game is just about controlling a growing civilization through different ages. You gather resources, build cities and armies, fight with other countries on a map. You know, it's fun. But there is one feature of the game where if you sort of build up enough resources and you've reached a certain late part of a match, you can build a civilization-specific building called a wonder. Like in the first game, if you were playing with the Egyptians, your wonder would be a great pyramid. And if you kept the building from being destroyed for a certain amount of time, you would automatically win the game. It was a cool feature. It, you know, puts you in the boots of a ruler who's, you know, kind of got it all. And what's the thing you build when you've already got it all? You build like a big old something to be remembered by. It's a little feature that's quite reflective of maybe a basic human instinct that we all have. Like, we all feel a little insecure about our mortality, and we would like to be remembered after we're gone. Now, if you have an entire civilization at your disposal, the thing that you want to be left that people will remember you by, well, you've got a fairly large scope to build kind of whatever you want. Maybe that's one of the reasons behind that we have these massive structures left behind by these ancient civilizations or kings, because they could do basically what they wanted. And if you felt like building a great pyramid, well, I guess you could go about doing that. So if we bring that sort of concept to our discussion about the Khmer Empire, a leader's power was sort of intrinsically tied to construction and architecture in Angkor, as each Khmer Devaraja built more elaborate and extensive monuments and other projects to sort of reinforce their divine kingship to their people, reinforce that link with the gods, and ensure that they will be remembered. In the last episode, we spoke about Phnom Bekeng, and the massive irrigation networks that were constructed by one of the first kings of the new capital city. So that was around the 900 AD mark. And if we fast forward about 200 years, the kingdom, you know, it's getting stronger, the capital larger. There are ups and downs, as you would expect any kind of civilization to go through over a 200-year time span. But in 1113 AD, King Suryavarman II came to power in Angkor. Now, he's one of the kings we need to talk about because he is going to build a wonder. One that has become almost synonymous with Cambodia itself and still inspires awe and marvel every day. I'm talking, of course, about the state temple of Suryavarman II. Angkor Wat. Surrounded by a moat almost 250 meters wide, the whole sort of monument and temple grounds occupies an area of about 400 acres. It is an imposing sight. You don't often see moats in your day-to-day goings about, and certainly not one this large. Again, this is going to be me giving you a verbal description of something much better seen with your own eyes, or short of that, virtually experienced, and you can go on like Google Street View or just look at some photos, but I'll give you a brief rundown of what this place is like and we'll see how we go. So if you can imagine this site from above, you've basically got a square moat measuring 1.5 kilometers on each side. Then, within that moat, you have an area of land that is about 1 kilometer long on each side. As you walk across the causeway to the temple, you see these three large towers at the front entrance in the middle of a long kind of terrace. Walking through that entrance under those towers, you step onto another long stone walkway that leads to the main kind of temple pyramid. There are a succession of walls and what are called galleries in this sort of square pattern that each get higher than the last, until in the center is what is called a quincunx. That's your word of the day for you right there, which is a kind of geometric pattern or arrangement of points in a cross. It's actually the shape of how the number 5 is shown on a die. So if you can imagine that shape, but with these marvelous stone towers stretching into the sky, with the central point of that pattern, a taller tower than the rest of them. Like other monuments of Angkor, this temple is representative of Mount Meru, which, as you remember, is the home of the gods in Hindu mythology. Unlike the majority of other temples at Angkor, however, this one is devoted to Vishnu rather than Shiva. What makes Angkor Wat especially memorable is the exquisite carvings or bas-reliefs that adorn most of the walls of the galleries. There are thousands of uniquely detailed figures and scenes which represent Hindu epics like the churning of the Sea of Milk. That's a story that does earn the title of being an epic. It's sort of a battle of gods against demons, where a tug of war between good and evil, using a giant snake, churns up the cosmic sea to try and get this elixir of immortality, and Vishnu has to turn himself into a giant turtle to support the mountain they're standing on. It's a doozy. So, yeah, stories like that are intricately carved out into the walls, and it is a real, proper masterpiece of world art. The temple is a work of genius. Many geniuses, really. It is the height of sophistication of Khmer artistry, architecture, and construction. Made all the more impressive when you just think about the staggering amount of labor and ingenuity required to get all of this stone to build the thing. They had to float all this sandstone from like 40 kilometers away. Actually, they got the sandstone from Mount Kulen, which is where you might remember the first Devaraja, Jayavarman II, had that first universal monarch ceremony. This ties into traditional Khmer ideas that associate ancestor and spirit worship, or Nikta, with certain holy sites and areas. So we see, even in sourcing the materials to build this site from a special location like Nom Kulen, that's in and of itself a spiritual act on behalf of the Khmer king. Angkor Wat truly deserves the title of a wonder, but it's not something that I want to spend too much time simply describing to you. So I do hope that if you haven't had the pleasure of visiting this place in person, that you might want to check out some of the photos or documentaries about this amazing monument. It does bring us to this kind of wider discussion I want to have about this period and why this is all important to our study of Cambodian history, though. So the trouble with explaining the history of the Khmer Empire and Angkorian period like I'm doing is that there is a tendency that I have actually a little bit fallen into, which is basically just to rattle off some of the big deal kings, tell you what they did, who they killed, what they built, and continue like that for a span of about 600 years until declaring that the Khmer just sort of abandoned Angkor and started making the country that would become Cambodia over the next 500 years or so. That retelling of history is kind of mirrored in a visit to what remains of Angkor today as well. Like, you walk around what is essentially the skeleton of what used to be that city. It would be like if you walked around a major city today, but you were only left with the skyscrapers and the banks, and a list of mayors of that town, but you had no information about anyone else. Well, that's certainly the impression I got on my first couple of visits to Angkor. I had no idea of the kind of mega city that actually existed there, but rather just sort of got the impression that the scattered remains of these marvelous temples and walls was all that city ever kind of was. Remember, there is basically nothing remaining of this city and its people that wasn't carved into stone or built using stone. It's why the study of this period does tend to follow just the exploits of kings and the things they built, because that's really all the evidence we have to inform our story. When I was first there, I had trouble trying to imagine what it actually looked like, imagining life going on there. Which is why the work of archaeologists, using a new technique called LIDAR mapping, is proving to sort of open up a whole new world and a whole new way of visualizing the Khmer Empire and studying this ancient civilization. So LIDAR, which is a word that's sort of a mix of laser and radar, it's a process where you bounce billions of laser pulses from an array on a helicopter onto the ground, and they bounce back up, and in doing so, you build a picture of the ground with incredible detail. Importantly for archaeologists studying Angkor, what this technique allows for is in one afternoon of flying above a certain area, you can scan up an incredibly detailed map of minute differences in the terrain that, when accumulated, shows you what kind of structures have vanished from view. You sort of get the foundation of what used to be there. So, as an example, let's say someone demolished all of the houses on your block and did their best job of sort of clearing away the debris. Scanning your block with a LIDAR detector would show up the few centimeters difference in height between the ground and what used to be the foundations of your flooring. I'd be able to see the way the ground was different between the grass on the perimeter of your house to where it was flattened to put in concrete features, stuff like that. What would have taken weeks of painstakingly sifting through dirt and finding old bits of brick that made up your walls and things like that can now be done in one afternoon. I could map out your whole suburb. Importantly for historians studying Angkor, this technique can penetrate the canopy of trees, which means all the previously inaccessible areas of Angkor that have been reclaimed by the jungle in this, you know, huge city can be seen from just flying up around in a helicopter. All the foundations and sort of areas that were made up of houses that have completely decomposed can be sort of mapped out with this new revolutionary technology. What this has done, it's sort of transformed the map of Angkor from, you know, a large area with a couple of roads, some reservoirs and temples, into a kind of map that you would think of when you pull up, you know, Google. Areas previously left blank are filled in with thousands of houses and networks of canals connecting them. We can see the impressions of ponds that seemingly every household had in their backyard. The area around Angkor Wat, previously thought to be empty or only accessible to elites and monks, is now a sort of bustling hive of thatched roofs and people going about their business or working at the monument itself. It is through this technique that historians and archaeologists are being able to breathe life back into the skeletal remains of Angkor and show that this was truly a mega city. Remember, this was the largest pre-industrial city in the world, with a population perhaps as large as 1 million. Now, on the Shadows of Utopia website, I'm going to leave a link to a documentary called Atlantis in the Jungle, which is about Angkor and the use of this technique by some of the archaeologists of the Greater Angkor Project, hosted in part by guys from the University of Sydney. Actually, on the podcast, I'll have an interview with Dr. Tom Chandler, who is using technologies like this and others to build a kind of simulation of Angkor that can even be experienced in virtual reality. And I hope you find that fascinating. It's stuff like this that can really transform your view of the city. And importantly, if you're actually going to visit the city, it can give you this whole new way of imagining it. Anyway, that's what's going on with the sort of modern archaeological techniques happening at the moment. But I'm getting a little sidetracked here, so let's just return back to where we were for a moment. Angkor Wat. So, Angkor Wat is the obvious example where we can point and say, alright, this is like the high watermark of the Khmer Empire. I mean, just like, look at the precision of this huge building. And just like in Age of Empires, when you build a wonder, people tend to come and try and break it. This is sort of what happened. In the next 100 years or so, the Khmer were attacked by the kingdom known as Champa and their people called the Chams. This kingdom and the descendants of this territory, they're going to come up again in our discussion of the crimes of the Khmer Rouge. So, you know, put a pin in that name. Remember that name, the Champa, the Chams. But for now, all you need to know is that for a while, the Chams were controlling Angkor in the period after their masterpiece was completed. I realize that we are immediately going back to the story as a succession of kings, who they fought, and what they built. But the next important guy in our story, Jayavarman VII, well, he's super important because he fights some people, he builds some stuff, and he is remembered as being the king that brings the Khmer Empire to its zenith. So in the extremely condensed version of events that I'm giving you, we have to spend some time talking about Jayavarman VII. So about 25 years after Angkor Wat is completed, the Chams led by Jaya Indravarman IV, they sail up from their territory, which is in modern-day central Vietnam. They sail their fleet all the way up the Mekong, into Cambodia, into the Great Lake of Cambodia, the Tonle Sap. From there, from the massive lake there, they go up the Siem Reap River, and they attack Angkor. About 2 years after the Chams sack Angkor, Jayavarman VII, who was in his 60s at this time, he leads a massive Khmer army to defeat the Cham invaders. And one of the most famous battles is said to have occurred on the Tonle Sap and is thought to be depicted on one of the walls of the temples that Jayavarman would build once assuming the kingship. So once Jayavarman VII defeats the Chams, you know, reunites the Khmer Empire, has all the territories under his control, he embarks on a 30-year building program, which is absolutely staggering in scope. He will use up all of the sandstone available, basically. He will build more in that 30 years than all of the previous kings of Angkor combined. So when you visit Angkor today, a significant amount of the temples and structures you will visit were all built by this one king in the late 12th and early 13th century. For instance, that walled city that our Chinese diplomat friend described at the intro to this episode, that's all built by Jayavarman VII. Called Angkor Thom, this sort of vast new addition to the Capitol would house some of the truly marvelous architectural wonders that would characterize the Khmer Empire's golden period. For example, one of the highlights and probably my personal favorite of these structures is the famous Bayon, which is known for the hundreds of huge stone smiling faces that adorn the towers of the temple and look out in every direction. Under his leadership, the Khmer Empire would stretch across most of mainland Southeast Asia. And this temple seems to be a recognition of that aspect of his rule. These stone faces, these huge smiling faces, which are believed to be a mixture of his own likeness and the manifestation of Buddha called Lokshvara, they literally see everything and they sit at the center of this massive empire. So this is actually a point we need to rest on for a little bit and explore, because it's a difference that marks Jayavarman VII's kingship away from his predecessors. He was the first Khmer monarch to be a practicing Mahayana Buddhist. And the difference in religion from Hindu to Buddhist in the case of a king is one of the elements of his reign that really stands out for historians today. So what are the kinds of things that differentiate a Hindu king from a Buddhist one? And why is this important for the story? Well, for starters, a Buddhist king like Jayavarman had a slightly different worldview than his predecessors. He was still obsessed with conquering territory, you know, defeating armies, building huge monuments that serve as grandiose reminders of how awesome he is. But he had a different perspective of his relationship to his subjects. Sort of, rather than seeing himself as a manifestation of a god and the people of his empire as tools for him to use, Jayavarman VII thought of himself as a bodhisattva, which is someone who can attain nirvana, but delays doing so in order to sort of alleviate the suffering of everyone else. The goal of such a person was to help others attain salvation and reduce suffering. This leads us to some of the more contradictory elements of Jayavarman VII's rule. So, like, on the one hand, he's often depicted as an ascetic, deep in meditation. Inscriptions tell us that he suffered from the illnesses of his subjects more than from his own. But then in some of the bas-reliefs on the Bayon Temple, we have depictions of, you know, vivid cruelty in the battles against the Chams, or inscriptions that praise his vengefulness and his skill at political infighting. It's this kind of phrase, you know, so on the one hand, but on the other hand, kind of thing that we associate with his rule. So, like his building program, part of it was erecting hundreds of hospitals around the empire, or these little rest stops that could be used by travelers that, you know, they were spaced out just at the right intervals for someone trekking along the roads from the kingdom out into the countryside or out into a different territory. So you could sort of walk for a whole day, and at that pace, you would go from one rest stop to another, which would protect you from, you know, people like bandits and stuff like that. So this is all nice stuff. I mean, this is stuff for the people, ostensibly designed to deliver his people from suffering, in his words. But the pace at which these projects were carried out, remember, this all happened in less than 30 years. The staggering amount of labor and materials needed to produce this would come at a huge physical cost to the people constructing them. Why was it all carried out in such a short amount of time? You know, it might have something to do with how old Jayavarman was when he attained the throne. Remember, he's in like his 60s. Was it a case of trying to do as much as possible before he died, no matter the cost? Do we take him at his word that these grandiose projects were an attempt to rescue his people? Or is it more just a reflection of his ego? Megalomania? It's hard to say. Perhaps the truth lies somewhere in the middle. Now, whatever we think of the character of Jayavarman VII's rule, he's generally considered as the most powerful of the Khmer Empire's rulers. He would die in his 90s, having overseen a staggering construction period, and the extent of his empire stretched farther than it ever had before. However, the extent of his power and the pace at which he demanded this kind of exponential growth, the things we use to justify this title of, you know, Jayavarman the Great, or his status as the most powerful king of that period, well, that sort of chalks up that high watermark for the Khmer Empire. And from that point on, the kingdom went into decline. The golden period ends after Jayavarman the VII's rule in the 13th century. And it's here that I want to stop talking about kings and battles and monuments and start talking about the people of Angkor and how this great empire fell apart. So before we get to the prevailing theories about how and why the Khmer Empire collapsed, we need to get back to Chao Tukan, or Zhao Daguan, depending on your pronunciation. I might swing between both. It's hard. Anyway, the Chinese diplomat whose description of the walled city sort of kicked off this episode. So, Zhao is hugely important for the study of Angkor. And the reason why is sort of what I was talking about earlier, about the sort of skeletal remains we have of Angkor. We've got nothing. We've got no remaining sources, really. We've just got inscriptions, which are a bit dry. We've got buildings, you know, we can learn a lot from the buildings and the pictures on the buildings. But this is a little more like sort of an obituary that, you know, would just talk about the king and his ancestors and in his deeds. Temples often function like little sort of taxing stations in a community, and people would give offerings of their harvests or slaves sometimes. They would even give their own children to these little sort of religious tax havens. And, you know, these temples, these little tax stations, they have inscriptions as well, but they almost read kind of like a tax return or something like that. You know, they've got X amount of people that work here, and this year X amount of rice was gathered. So it's not like you can really get some colourful information out of these inscriptions. I mean, you can get lots of stuff. You can learn about the functions of the empire in a certain way, but you miss out on the human element of what was happening back then. You don't really get any sort of voices of the people. It leaves a lot to the imagination. Now, there are obvious reasons for this lack of information as well. It would be like if I asked you to keep a diary, but you needed to carve that diary into a rock every day. I mean, you probably wouldn't be bothered. Or in the same way that most of the information about your life is probably stored in like a digital space, unless you still keep a handwritten diary, if all of that digital information about you was erased, how would someone come up with a picture of who you were or what you did? So while we do know that the Khmer were writing lots of stuff down, like there were libraries and stores of information, no doubt, and these would give us huge insights into the goings-on of this advanced civilization, none of that has survived. It was all written down on palm leaves or perishable materials. So just like all the houses of the million or so inhabitants of Angkor, you know, like they've disappeared. Sadly, practically all of their voices have also disappeared. Now, this is where Chao Tukwan becomes super important. He was a Chinese diplomat who stayed in Angkor. Now, remember, the Khmer Empire traded with China, and they had a lot of links with China. He stayed in the city for about a year in 1296. Now, that is about 70 years after the great Jayavarman the VII had died. Now, what makes Zhao so important is that after he got back to China, he wrote a book. Now, his book about his stay in Angkor is called The Customs of Cambodia. Now, unfortunately, even his book hasn't fully survived the passage of time, and apparently we are only left with about a third of what the entire thing would have amounted to. but what is in there is absolute gold. The English translation can be read in sort of like under an hour, and is sort of a number of little vignettes and chapters about some of the more, I guess, mundane aspects of Angkor, but aspects that are sorely missing from the historical picture. He writes about different birds, the clothing of the natives, what relationship slaves had to their masters. He gives us tantalizing descriptions of the temples that inform our understanding of how they would have been adorned or painted all those years ago. So I'm going to touch on a few sections of the customs of Cambodia, but not go into too much detail because we will come back to Zhao's account when I interview Dr. Tom Chandler on the podcast. So this won't be the last we hear from our 13th century tour guide. So, early on in the book, Joe tells us about sort of people and classes in Angkor. He says that different houses had different materials used for roofs depending on a person's status. He says, "Straw thatch covers the dwellings of the commoners, not one of whom would dare put the smallest bit of tile on his roof." He talks about three religious groups enjoying a privileged status at this time in Angkor. The Brahmins, or Hindus, the Theravada monks, and the Shivaites, which he calls followers of the Tao, but it's believed that he was just sort of mistaken there. The Brahmins, he says, had roles like that of officials, that the Theravada monks dressed in yellow, much like they still do in Cambodia. And the Shivaites, they sort of had a lower status than the monks. Their monasteries were smaller than the Buddhist ones. The Shivaites were Hindus, and they were still practicing the Indianized cult we talked about in the first episode, where they worshipped the Linga or Lingam. At a different point in the book, he also states that worship of the Buddha was universal at Angkor at this time. At this point, the Hindu religions were actually diminishing in importance at Angkor, and Cho's account sort of reinforces that to historians. So, Zhou's account also makes it clear that many of the people living at Angkor were, in some sense, slaves. He says that families of wealth may own more than 100, or those of lesser means, they would content themselves with, say, 10 or 20 slaves, but that only the very poorest people have no slaves. He explains that most of these slaves were taken as captives from the mountain tribes of Cambodia, which is a practice that occurred as late as the colonial era in the country. He explains that these slaves were governed by many prohibitions. For example, they lived under the house, they had to kneel and bow when they entered the house, they could only do that when they were working. They called their masters mother or father, and if they were caught trying to escape, they would be tattooed, mutilated, or shackled by the neck. In one of the less salacious sections of the book, Zhao delves into a fair bit of detail about a New Year's festival that he witnessed. He speaks about a platform being set up that could fit thousands of people. Across a bank from this platform were scaffolds, large scaffolds, set up with huge fireworks that could be seen from more than 13 kilometers away. This ceremony, attended by the king and accompanied by sort of other foreign dignitaries, appears to have been celebrated at the end of the rainy season, when the waters of the Great Lake begin to subside, which sets in motion the first stages of the Cambodian agricultural year. After the move to Phnom Penh in the 15th century, the ceremony actually became known as the Water Festival, and was basically celebrated in the same way until, like, the 1970s, when the monarchy was overthrown in the Lon Nol coup. It's just one of many things mentioned in the book where we see this long sort of continuity between sort of traditions in the deep past and in the more modern times for Cambodians. Xu also gives us plenty of information about agriculture in the book, including the statistic about 3 or 4 harvests being possible in 1 year. The grand poobah of Cambodian historians, David Chandler, he notes that we would welcome the chance to interrogate Zhao Duguan about the workings of agriculture at this time. For example, how was rice surplus handled? Were cultivators for the most part free people, or were they in some way slaves? Did agriculture differ markedly at Angkor from the rest of the kingdom? How much land was in the hands of members of the royal family? And how much was controlled by the Buddhist Wats? He says that we have no answers to these questions, and we must be grateful to Zhao for what he gives us, even though in many cases it is just a tantalizing glimpse. Now, speaking of a tantalizing glimpse, the book ends in what I would call classic Daguan style with the chapter Bathing in Cambodia. He says, Cambodia is an excessively hot country, and it is impossible to get through the day without bathing several times. Even at night, 1 or 2 baths are imperative. There are no bathhouses, but every family owns a pond, or at times several families own one in common. He goes on to discuss some of the rules, some of the conventions about who can bathe when, and then he says, every few days, the women of the town, in groups of 3 or 5, stroll down to the river to bathe. Here at the water's edge, they drop the strip of cotton that clothes them, joining thousands of other women in the river. Even the women of noble birth mingle in these baths and think nothing of it, even though they show themselves from head to foot to any bystanders who may appear. Not a day passes without this happening. On days of leisure, the Chinese often treat themselves to the spectacle. In fact, I've heard it said that many of them even enter the water to take advantage of whatever opportunity offers. While certainly salacious, and perhaps just indicating to us who the kinds of people that Zhao is writing for, it's actually kind of informative. The mention of family ponds has been confirmed through using that LiDAR mapping I spoke about earlier, which gives us this fantastic little picture of one of the common ways that people would have relaxed in Angkor, and also further evidence the sort of the city and the relationship of the people there to the water. So, that's a taste of what a 13th century Chinese diplomat might talk about after he comes back from holiday. Now, when talking about Zhou's account of Angkor, it's important to remember that the Khmer Empire is already in the period following the Golden Age. It's already considered to be, by historians, to be in decline or transforming into what is generally considered the abandonment of Angkor and the end of the Khmer Empire in 1431. So what are the main reasons that this happens? Well, roughly speaking, there are 3 proposed ideas which led to the collapse of the Khmer civilization. The rise of the Thai kingdoms to the west, the widespread conversion to Theravada Buddhism, and the third is a new theory which posits some kind of environmental calamity sort of really affecting the Khmer Empire. So we'll deal with the first reason, the rise of the Thai kingdoms first. This is a theme that's going to become increasingly important as this series goes on. In fact, most of Cambodian history is characterized by this kind of existential threat posed by the powerful neighbors of Cambodia, Thailand to the west and Vietnam to the east. Even during Zhou Duguan's stay, he is talking about wars with Siam having occurred or that are ongoing. The rise of the Sukhothai kingdom in the 13th century meant that a previously subdued people who had been dominated by the Khmer Empire, widely used as conscripts or for tributes, they became a kingdom of their own. Their rise to prominence in that region coincided with the rise of Theravada Buddhism throughout Southeast Asia on that western side. So from Ceylon or Sri Lanka to the Mon and Pagan kingdoms in Burma, the Theravada variant of Buddhism spread across from west to east into the Khmer Empire. We will get back to this in a second, but for now it's important to note that there was a consolidated territory and people that would become Thailand, and their rise to prominence occurred in the late 13th century. What used to be a reliable source of tribute for the Khmer Empire became a rival and a threat, culminating in these Thai kingdoms' continual invasion of Angkor, to the point of Siamese princes being placed on the throne at Angkor. After periods of winning the throne back and then losing again, the Khmer king Ponhir Yat, he finally decided to abandon Angkor as indefensible, and he moved the Khmer capital towards the center of Cambodia, and eventually Phnom Penh, which is the modern capital. So the rise of the Thai kingdoms is a pretty big deal if you're explaining the collapse of the Khmer Empire. Essentially, the capital city was way too close to a growing rival and threat, and you were constantly being invaded. But why had the Khmer gotten to the point that they were weak enough to give up against this threat? Well, one reason that is tentatively put forth has to do with the rise of Theravada Buddhism in the region and the adoption of this faith by the Khmer at Angkor. The theory goes that the conversion to this variant of Buddhism, different to both Mahayana Buddhism and Hinduism, naturally, it's more of a austere religion. Its focus is on the introspective nature of the mind and the path to the alleviation of suffering through this introspection and sort of a conservative view of the monkhood and Buddhism. Now, this focus may have undermined traditional power structures that were so important to the function and maintenance of critical features of the city at Angkor. For example, this to me kind of seems like the equivalent of thinking that your king isn't just a king. He's a manifestation of God. Like, what wouldn't you do for someone you thought was basically divine? I mean, nothing, right? You're going to do whatever they say. Which might go a long way in explaining why some of these massive monuments were built. It's like, who's ready for another day of back-breaking labor, am I right? Sure thing, God King. Hopefully, by serving the God King just right, I can come back in my next life as someone who's in slightly less pain. These kind of things. Maybe that's a hugely reductive way of thinking about people in the past, but it's simple. So what if there was a new religion in town, which not only said that your king wasn't really a god, he was still a big deal, but that maybe the way you can alleviate the suffering in your life is to turn to the teachings of a guy who actually renounced being a prince and lived a life of careful mindfulness, Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha. Suddenly your devotion to doing whatever you can do for your God King, you know, giving up certain amounts of your harvest or like I said earlier, even giving up some of your kids to sort of Hindu taxation points, maybe that doesn't seem so relevant anymore. This theory shouldn't be seen as a contribution to the decline of the empire in and of itself, but rather as a possible factor taken with the other three mentioned in a sort of consonance. One problem with it being the only reason would be to sort of point at the Thai kingdom. They were all Theravada Buddhist and they were kicking the Khmer Empire's ass. So the religion by itself can't be seen as the sole influencer of the decline. But perhaps marginally, for instance, maybe some of the labor that the Devaraja relied on to maintain some of the important structures around Angkor began to be minimalized due to this shift in devotion, which may have came at a crucial time in regards to environmental change, which is the third and most recent factor, which is sort of given by archaeologists and historians to the collapse of Angkor. So that aspect, the environmental one, is really gone into detail in that documentary that I mentioned earlier, the Jungle Atlantis one, which I really do highly recommend watching for anyone who is sort of thinking of visiting the region or maybe wanting to follow up on some of the stuff we've talked about in this episode. The theory, which is quite convincing, has been really rising to prominence following the work of organizations like the Greater Angkor Project, which are using really high-tech methods to investigate Angkor, like the LiDAR mapping we talked about earlier, but also, core samples of rivers, tree boring, to really build up a large set of data about the region over the last 1,000 or so years. So when doing these kinds of studies, scientists can come up with a high degree of certainty about certain things that would have happened in this period, the 13th and 14th centuries. There may have been serious environmental catastrophes in the region around Angkor during this period. Basically, extended droughts followed by destructive monsoons can be seen in these kinds of scientific data. What we're talking about really is climate change. So, if you remember the last episode, you will recall that the complex relationship that the Khmer fostered with the elements and the mastery of these factors was pretty much the whole reason that the civilization prospered in the first place. You might remember that line I bastardized from The Simpsons and Scarface. First you build the lakes, then you get the water, then you get the rice, then you get the power. Okay, so what if Mother Nature shoves a big friggin' stick into that process? Suddenly, those monsoon rains you wait half the year for, they're not coming. Or they barely come at all. So all those lakes you've built? Yeah, that doesn't mean much anymore because there's no rain for them to catch. Those artificial lakes were the backbone of the city of Angkor. Remember, this is like an aquatic city. Instead of roads and train lines, they had these waterways that connected everything. It's almost like the electricity of this city. So by this point, the population of Angkor is huge, around 1 million, yeah? So you need vast amounts of rice to be able to support that growing population. So with less rain, what are you going to do? Well, one idea would be to make bigger reservoirs. Okay, sure. So you go to work cutting down trees to help build the new reservoirs, these huge artificial lakes. You clear out some forest, you build some new areas for rice farming. And that might work for a while, but then, bam, the monsoons come back harder than ever. And when they do, they cause flooding because all of those reservoirs that you've changed to deal with the drier seasons now can't handle this massive influx of water. And the flooding is even worse than usual because all the trees that you've cut down, they were keeping back the runoff from the hills, and now that is, as soil and silt, that's running into your canals and reservoirs, raising the bottom layer of that, and basically rendering them useless. So it was this kind of 1-2 punch, where at a particularly fragile time, the complex system which served as the veins of this whole megacity kind of collapsed and everything ground to a halt. Again, imagine if the roads and trains stopped working in your city. How long before you would just sort of pack up and move somewhere else? Particularly if those new neighbors of yours in the city next over, if they kept coming over and beating you and everyone else up every few years, and you've also just converted to this new religion, where you aren't really even sure if you can be bothered doing anything too extreme for this king of yours anymore. Again, this is a sort of gross simplification, I guess you could say. But it's in this general way that historians think that a sort of confluence of factors influenced the decisions to just abandon Angkor. Now, it needs to be said that these are just the prevailing theories we have about the so-called collapse of Angkor. The truth is, we don't know for sure. We don't have enough evidence. A historian like David Chandler would even go so far as to challenge the basic elements of these traditional reasons given for the so-called collapse of Angkor. In his must-read book, A History of Cambodia, he states that perhaps the date of 1431 isn't all that relevant. Yes, the Thai invasion that occurred then was of a large scale, but there is evidence that Angkor may have still been occupied by Khmer well into the 1560s. There is no reason to think that Angkor Wat was ever truly abandoned, as we have evidence of Buddhist monks living there for this entire time period. Key to all these ideas is thinking not so much of a decline or collapse of Angkor, but he says to think of it more as a change or transformation. The movement of the Khmer population away from the western border to the more central location of Phnom Penh may have been influenced by the growing interconnectedness with Chinese maritime trade expansion undertaken by the Mongols or the early Ming dynasties. The massive amounts of population flux, remember these Thai invasions, when you got invaded in these sort of time periods, you would often lose like vast amounts of your population. They'd be taken back to that territory as sort of spoils of war. This shouldn't be thought simply of stealing these Khmer people either. It might be more accurate to think of these populations in a more fluid manner, so that ideas and customs may have been traded across this western frontier in a way that eroded traditional Angkorian-era customs, like the building of these great monuments that we've been spending so much time on, or the Indianized royal cults or inscription-making. This entanglement with the Thai court and Theravada traditions, as well as the lack of sources from these later periods of Angkor, this might just give us the impression of a steep decline or collapse, but that those words don't properly reflect the reality of the situation. Whatever the truth of the matter may be, we will leave the story of Cambodia here for now. At the beginning of a new period of Cambodian history, the so-called Middle Period, or as some would say, the Dark Ages of Cambodia. As David Chandler says, those dates 802, when Jayavarman II started the Devaraja cult, and 1431, the date of the Thai sacking of Angkor, they mark neither a beginning nor an end, but rather they indicate to us Cambodia's period of greatness. Those were the highs, and unfortunately for the people of Cambodia, the lows were still to come, and they would last a long time. Elements of the story that I've explained so far would prove to be important in the centuries that would follow, important even to the architects of Cambodia's darkest period in the revolution of the Khmer Rouge. We still need to bridge the gap between the medieval era and the modern, and that will be the focus of the next episode of In the Shadows of Utopia, as we look at the so-called dark period of Cambodian history and the rise of colonial powers and their imperialist grip on the world map and Indochina. The importance of the threat posed by Cambodia's new powerful neighbours and how they would seek the protection of a European power to ensure their safety, their survival. All that and more coming soon. I also want you to keep an eye out for a very special bonus episode that I mentioned earlier. I interviewed the creator of the Virtual Angkor Project, Dr. Tom Chandler of Monash University. We talk about the trouble using Zhao Taquan as a source, the lessons we can learn from virtual simulations, and lots more. It's a fascinating chat, and I can't wait to share it with you all. Again, I just want to thank you so much for listening. This is a work in progress, and I hope you are enjoying it. If you are enjoying it, perhaps you'd like to help out the show by leaving a review on iTunes or wherever you might listen to this podcast. You can check out the website at www.shadowsofutopia.com, where you can find out more information about the show. We've got supplementary material there, like pictures and maps, and you can find out more about me, Lachlan Peters. We have contact information there as well if you need. So, until next time.